Hello, I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save, with customised coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping?
It's just so beautiful. Oh, yeah, nice, the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
In 2003, surfer Bethany Hamilton was surfing off the island of Kauai when a tiger shark made, well, short work of a left arm during a break in activities. The combination of her grit, resilience, definitely her faith, and a desire to never give up place this attack and ensuing story within the pantheon of recountings that can be extremely uplifting. Peter Benchley's Jaws, however, which was made into a movie in 1975, conversely created a near satanic panic over the subject of sharks, to the point that it affected water tourism immensely all over the world. It also had a profound psychological impact on viewing audiences that would rival those of the still to this day unmatched horror film, The Exorcist. Hamilton's story is real, and Jaws is an artistic projection of what a rogue great white shark might inflict on a seafaring community. But another episode in history, if it was ever made into a film, would send another line of would-be consumers off the Xanax Turnpike, a maritime military strike that would send 1,100 men into the ocean, with only 316 ever seeing the light of day again, courtesy of dehydration, drowning, and of course, violent attacks at the mercy of a frenzied pack of tiger sharks. And to top it off, an even sadder footnote to an already harrowing story is about to follow. Today, we will talk about the USS Indianapolis on box number 7. It was July 16th of 1945. The USS Indianapolis set sail out of the port of San Francisco, carrying uranium-235 in a secret and unescorted mission to drop off their radioactive cargo. Arriving in Tinian on July 26th, the uranium was transferred into a set of hands that would ultimately be dropped on Hiroshima to end World War II. Whether or not the crew understood they were carrying the innermost element to the little boy atomic bomb is debatable. What they didn't count on, however, is that most of them would never live to see the fruition of that fateful and terrifying day. The Indianapolis found a brief holdover in Guam and then set out for the Philippines. Naval intelligence had deemed the route to be safe from the need to engage in the measures necessary to protect them from enemy submarine fire. However, this assessment would be sidelined almost immediately because at approximately midnight on July 30th, Japanese submarine I-58, commanded by Mochitsura Hashimoto, would let loose a fusillade of torpedoes, 6 to be exact, towards the starboard side of the Indianapolis. And unfortunately, 2 of them made direct contact. Communications were immediately severed, and within 12 minutes, the Indianapolis was gone beneath the waves of the Philippine seawater. General assessments indicate that 300 men were lost almost instantly, a combination of being trapped below decks as well as being pulled under in a vortex created by a maritime giant cascading downward into Davy Jones's locker. Survivors would suffer at the hands of the mission's top secret status, because no one knew they were out there, and therefore help was not a presumptive thing to look forward to. Various accounts speak of the dehydration, sun exposure, saltwater poisoning from those attempting to drink the briny ocean water, and others giving away to hallucinations. And then, from out of nowhere, sharks. Estimated between 12 and 150 of them, a combination of oceanic whitetip and tiger sharks. The attacks would intermittently happen over a three-day period. Descriptions of screaming men being pulled under water accompany most accounts. Fins slicing through the water in predatory attacks. A constant and overwhelming fear. The men would attempt to gather in groups, attempting to stem the attacks. Most of the time, to no avail. When all was said and done, 316 men remained, emaciated and riding the edge of their own psychological tolerance. 4 days later, a veritable eternity in terms of maritime survivability, and 4 days before the infamous bomb would obliterate Hiroshima, a U.S. Navy patrol plane accidentally came upon the incident. The oil slick created by the damage had alerted the pilots to something being amiss down below. So, without glossing over this, let's stop and think for a minute about something. When you hear the phrase, "they were found 4 days later," it's easy to brush that off as a chronological blip in time. And if you were lost in the woods in a temperate zone, it might be the case. But floating in an ocean where 80% of your body is submerged before buoyancy is achieved, hypothermia is imminent no matter how warm the water is because it's still less than body temperature. You have no shelter from the sun, with one exception. The times when there is no sun because you are now subject to a black ocean with a minor illumination from the stars above you. And if there was a bright moon, it gives you visibility to a host of traumatized silhouettes, but also makes you one to whatever may be lurking beneath you. And it's the unknown that is killing you. No sense of time, no ability to see beyond the waves that engulf you, nothing. Only the cries, anger, cursing, deliriums, and sudden fits of mania, and the panicked screams of men slipping beneath the depths. You're too weak to help, but you can hear them die next to you. It's this that makes the weight of the story. But I can tell you one thing. Sharks certainly didn't help. So when they were discovered, one can only imagine the twisted relief that they felt. But this isn't even the saddest part of the story. Captain Charles B. McVeigh III was later court-martialed for not attempting to zigzag his vessel in an avoidance maneuver when attacked by the Japanese submarine. He would live for years under the stigma of having been responsible for the deaths of so many men, right or wrongly accused. And he would succumb to the pressure in 1968, where Captain McVeigh would take a loaded weapon and remove himself from the traumatic equation. He would take his life 30 years before an 11-year-old boy would inadvertently exonerate him, interviewing surviving members for a sixth-grade history fair. The student compiled a testimonial backlog that would place the responsibility not on the feet of McVeigh, but higher up the chain, indifferent superiors who were not on the water and, quite frankly, had far less experience in the water. The U.S. Navy restored his honor thanks to the footwork of one kid. Well, McVeigh had one other unlikely supporter in his camp prior to his death and afterward, too. It would be Mochitsura Hashimoto, the man responsible for sinking his wartime adversary. While the Navy was engaged in the systematic destruction of a captain's reputation, Hashimoto was testifying that McVeigh could not have known or have anticipated the presence of their sub because of the maneuvers and tactical things they were performing below the surface. The Navy, at the time, brushed it aside and court-martialed McVeigh anyhow, who, as previously stated, would ultimately undertake a suicide solution. Hashimoto continued to fight for his former adversary's honor and ultimately worked for his restoration with the United States Navy. McVeigh's honor was restored in the year 2000, ironically after he had successfully survived the first shark attack back in 1945. but succumbing to one far worse at the administrative level and military compliments. Hashimoto died of old age the same year. Amazing and sad. And this is box number 7.